I want to move on to a story about the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. They've apologised to the family of a 12-year-old girl who had to wait over 2 hours for an ambulance after she fell off her bike and suffered a back injury. The Northern Ireland Ambulance Service say she was categorised as a Category B call, potentially serious but not immediately life-threatening, and an emergency vehicle should have been with her within 21 minutes. That didn't happen. I've been speaking to the girl's mother and asked her what happened.
We were out for a cycle ride after dinner because it's a nice evening, and there's a grass bank on Greensport at the front, and we were racing down it. Sounds irresponsible, but it's just a fun thing to do with a mum and daughter. And unfortunately, she changed gear, and as she was racing down the hill, and her bike seized, and she took a really bad tumble over the handlebars with her bike and landed badly, screamed in immediate pain and couldn't breathe properly. So I sort of went straight to her, assessed her, and realised that she had pain, or she said she had pain down her leg and in her lower back, sent alarm bells ringing for me. And so I thought, I need to speak to, get some medical advice. So a member of the public was nearby. We didn't have mobile phones on us, and they called the ambulance service.
And when you said when you said your daughter couldn't breathe properly, can you describe to me how bad she was?
I've got three children, you know, I'm used to them having knocks and bumps and falls and things. But she had sharp pain in her lower back and a weird sensation in her leg. So I immediately thought she's damaged her back in some way. And as I say, it just sent alarm bells ringing.
And we're all told in those situations when the back or the neck is affected at all, be careful how you move someone and get medical attention. And that's what you were trying to do.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. As I say, the member of the public spoke to the ambulance service because I was concentrating on her, because she was struggling to breathe at that point, and I think also it was the panic of what had happened was setting in. So they spoke to the ambulance service on my behalf, and they were relaying what she was telling us. And they said, you know, do not move her under any circumstances. And if she did try to move her leg or her arm, she was screaming in pain. So I knew something, you know, wasn't right, and not to move her.
So what happened? The neighbour phoned the ambulance service, and then you're waiting for the ambulance to arrive, and that's why we're doing the story. How long did they take?
Well, we were waiting about an hour. My husband came to the green, and he said, I told him what had happened, and he said, well, where are they then? How did they tell you how long they're going to be? And I said, no, and we checked the time and realised it had been an hour. And he said, well, let's phone them back and find out where they are. And, we made contact with the ambulance service, and they couldn't give us a time. They said, you know, there was issues with people coming on duty or something, and they couldn't give us a specific time. And I said, well, what, 1 hour, 2 hours? You know, how much longer do we have to wait? She's in a lot of pain. And she was deteriorating as well at that point. You know, she was starting to shake from being on the cold, damp grass for that amount of time. And she needed some pain relief. And so we came off the phone, and I thought, right, you start racking your brain thinking, right, what else can I do? You know, there must be some other way out of this. So I phoned the out-of-hours GP and asked if, you know, they could come out and give her some sort of pain relief, gas and air or something. But they too were under a lot of pressure and were in Downpatrick at that time.
So by this stage, as you've described, your daughter is deteriorating. She's clearly in pain and there's no ambulance in sight, and it's an hour later.
Yeah, and then I think because of the shock of it all, I didn't think about going to the local shop. And somebody said to me, go and get some paracetamol from the local shop. So I went over to the local shop and got some Calpol and Nurofen. And I saw the defibrillator outside the shop, and I thought, gosh, I wonder if they have first aider or somebody in the shop. So I asked, and that's how I came into contact with the shop owner, Alan. And he came out and spoke to me, and he said, no, unfortunately, I don't know anybody. He said, but please let me put a call in on your behalf and see if we can, you know, establish a time for the ambulance. And I said, oh, no, I've already got the out-of-hours doctor doing that. The out-of-hours doctor said that they would escalate, because apparently because of the situation with the ambulance service on Friday night, they were colour-coding calls from green, amber and red. And he said he would escalate the ambulance request. So I went back over to my doctor, to my daughter, and gave her pain relief. And then by this time, you know, it's over 2 hours we've been waiting for.
2 hours? Waiting for an ambulance? 2 hours? Your daughter in distress for that amount of time? That's crazy.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable. And, you know, it was a very damp area as well, as you know, down by the seafront there. And the midges, I mean, I was having to hover over her face really closely to keep all the midges off her as well.
I know you think I know you think, and I'm going to have to be brief here because we're running out of time, but I know you think that when the ambulance team did arrive that they did a good job, but how can you sum up how you feel about the amount of time your daughter had to wait to get help?
Well, I just feel that, you know, yes, nothing was broken, and so I'm able to have a reasonable conversation with everybody about it now. But my goodness, if it had been a different outcome, I just can't imagine people having to wait that long. We weren't to know that she didn't have a broken bone in her neck or damage to her spine at that point. And you just can't begin to imagine the panic we were going through. And, you know, 2.5 hours in the end, it was just unbelievable. Words can't describe how, in this day and age, you know, you have to go through that to wait for an ambulance.
Well, listen, we are going to talk to the representatives of the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service now, but thank you very much indeed for bringing this your story, Emma. I hope your daughter's okay.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, listening to that, Michael Bloomfield from the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. Morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Stephen.
2 hours.
Yes, Stephen, that is an unacceptable length of time for any parent to wait and have to watch their child in pain and in distress. So I certainly apologise to Emma this morning and indeed to her daughter. I understand how anxious that would have been, how distressing. And she was rightly concerned about her daughter.
And does that happen often?
Well, unfortunately, Stephen, at present, our waiting times for calls do exceed the length of time that they should. As was described during that call, they are categorised into red, amber and green. Red are the immediately life-threatening calls. We are standard to respond to those is to respond to 72% of them within 8 minutes. We're currently only able to respond to about 38-39% within 8 minutes. And that then has a knock-on to those lower urgent calls, the ambers, that are a significant proportion of those are not responded to within 21 minutes. And on occasions, some calls do wait for very long times, depending on the availability of our crews at any point in time, which was the case on Friday night, unfortunately.
What I'm trying to understand in an incident like this, so I get it that you have to triage the calls. In other words, you have to prioritise where your resources go depending on what is the most critical incident. I get that. I think everybody understands that. But without, what I don't understand, Michael, is without actually seeing the person on the ground, and therefore assessing through the professionals' own eyes how badly injured they are, how can you be sure that leaving someone that amount of time and pushing them down the priority list is safe?
Well, that triage system, Stephen, is used extensively throughout the UK and indeed further beyond to categorise calls very effectively based on the information that is gathered. The first question that is asked is if the patient is breathing and conscious, and indeed in this case, you know, it was confirmed that the girl was breathing normally. So we have got a range of questions that are asked about each condition that categorise the urgency, and that is accurate. But on top of that, we have got a paramedic in our control room in what we call a clinical support desk, and certain calls are passed to that paramedic who can ask more questions, and they can either increase the urgency of that or potentially decrease it. And the paramedic on the clinical support desk was in contact with the young girl's mother and got the information, and it was of the view that this call did remain appropriate to be a Category B.
And of course, category B means potentially serious. So
yeah.
that very description in itself means that you're not sure. It's potentially serious. It might be serious.
It's not. It isn't the case that we're not sure. It's the Category A calls are potentially life-threatening. There's always an element of potential in those. So the Category A, which are the most serious, are potentially life-threatening. We're currently categorising, and I don't want to take this discussion in a different way than on this particular case, but just for a little bit of context, we are currently categorising about one-third of our calls as Category A. We receive about 600 calls a day into emergency ambulance control. We're currently categorising about one-third of those, about 200, as Category A. We consulted earlier in the year on a new clinical response model that will categorise more like 7 or 8% of those as truly life-threatening, requiring an 8-minute call, and that will allow us to provide a more accurate, sophisticated target response to all of our calls.
So if you are labelling 200 calls a day as potentially life-threatening, how many ambulances do you have across Northern Ireland to service those 200 calls a day?
And that's just 200 Category A. We've got to service all, 600 calls. They don't all get an ambulance, but again, I don't want to...
I get that. But of the 200, like, how many ambulances do we have?
At any point in time across the whole of Northern Ireland, we have about 60 emergency ambulances. And this now we're talking the double crew emergency ambulances with the blue lights. At any point in time, we have about 60. It can be a few more or a few less depending on the day of the week and day shift, night shift. We put them on based on when we know are the busiest days of the week.
Weekends, in other words.
So it's about 60. Now, in the southeastern and Belfast divisions, there would have been 18 due to be on that night shift. When the call came in, it was actually a day shift, and this was one of the issues that was picked up in your interview with the young girl's mother, that shifts the staff change shift. So our staff come on and off shift at 7:30 or 8:00. Some of them start the night shift at 7:30, some started at 8:00. So when the call came in at about 6:30, we had the full complement of emergency crews in the Ards and Bangor area. That's 5 crews across Ards and Bangor, and that's what was in our statement, which is now being questioned. Then at 8:00, between 7:30 and 8:00, when the night shift came on, there's 4 across Ards and Bangor, but they operate within a larger area. The crews go and they're deployed to wherever the need is. So there are 18 crews across the Belfast and southeastern divisions, which covers a large area in the east of the province. There's 18, should be 18. We only had 12. In fact, we were 6 short. None of those were in Ards and Bangor. Now,
why was there 6 short?
Currently, we have a high number of vacancies. We are training and recruiting as many staff as we can.
6 short on the one shift. 6 ambulance crews short on the one shift.
Across those 2 divisions of Belfast and South Eastern.
But 6 out of 18 is a third.
That's correct, yes. And that's why our emergency controllers, when the calls come in, they are having to deploy the resources that we do have to the most clinically urgent calls.
And that's not down to money? That's down to recruitment?
It's not down to money. We are currently recruiting and training as many staff as we can, but it takes time. It takes, if it's one of our existing
staff... But that's
staff,
about forward planning, surely.
And we are forward planning, Stephen. We've been allocated $4.7 million by the department last year in this to train 48 paramedics. It takes the best part of a year to train our existing staff to become paramedics. During that time, those 48 staff who are being trained to be paramedics are not available for operational calls.
Is it safe? If at the moment you are six short, you're a third crews short of what you plan that you need, is that safe?
That was on that particular night shift in those two divisions.
But it must be happening time and time again because, you know, it's a recruitment issue. It's a manpower issue. So if you're six short that weekend or that particular shift, you're bound to be six short again until you train these people up.
There are other shifts and there are other divisions that would be short at different times. It's particularly a challenge at evenings and at weekends. We are heavily reliant currently on the goodwill of our staff to work overtime until we fill vacancies. We've also got, as all organisations, you have a certain number of people who are not available for work for a number of reasons, including sick leave. We are in the peak holiday period, so our staff, like others, will be on annual leave. So taking account of vacancies, holiday periods, sick leave, and a range of other potential factors, we are reliant on our staff to do overtime. We also supplement when we don't have the full capacity available. We supplement it with use of private ambulance services and voluntary ambulance services, and our whole system is geared to prioritising the most clinically urgent calls, regrettably.
Why didn't you supplement it with private ambulances that night?
There would have been. Yes. Well, this is an ongoing operational role, Stephen, day in, day out, that our staff are looking at. Where are we light? Where can we match up? If there's two people on an ambulance crew, if one of them's not available, where can we match the other one up with someone else?
And when you say six people short, is that six individuals or is that six crews short?
These are double-personed crews. And we were short six vehicles, which would be 12 people. But some of those, then, we will match up people from two divisions in order to put out a double.
But hold on a minute. That's even worse than I thought. So that's six crews short out of 18.
On that shift in those two divisions.
But that's a quite a frequent pattern, is what you're saying.
Yes, it's not uncommon currently between vacancies, annual leave and sick leave that we do not have our full complement of staff.
But so annual leave and sick leave, I'm sure there must be some type of equation or formula. And of course, you can't get it exact, but there's always going to be people sick and there are always going to be people taking annual leave. And you're saying this morning, Michael, nearly as a matter of course, yeah, it's always going to be the case. We're going to be sick short. Six crews short is six.
Stephen, I hope it didn't come across as saying as a matter of course. What I'm saying, and I'm being open with you, having that number of crews short at a shift at a weekend is not uncommon. We work constantly. It's what many of our staff do all week is spend their time trying to maximise that cover by phoning staff to see who are available to come in to do additional work, additional shift on overtime, by sourcing voluntary and private ambulance service. But this is a short-term pressure that we have. Demand for our services currently exceeds our capacity, and we're investing heavily in recruiting and training staff, but it takes time. It takes time to get those staff into the organisation and get them trained, but we're now progressing that. In addition, we have consulted on that new clinical response model, which will allow us to target our resources more effectively. I'm sure you and your listeners can understand that if we are trying to respond to a third of our calls, treating them as immediately life-threatening and therefore trying to respond within 8 minutes, and many of those calls are not truly life-threatening, that if we are able to categorise those more appropriately and it's more 7 or 8%, then we can provide a more targeted response to meet everybody's needs.
How long have we been six crews short for?
What do you mean? That was a particular shift, but to have that proportion of crews short in a particular division on a night shift, that would have been a feature fairly regularly. It has increased over the last 2 or 3 months, but certainly over the past couple of years, we have not had our full funded capacity.
I guess, Michael, that brings me back to my point this morning to you, which is it seems to be some type of pseudo-acceptable, par-for-the-course situation because it's happening so regularly. Like your own words, it's happening frequently over the past couple of years that we are six crews short through whatever reason, whatever reasoning, but it's happening regularly. Is that acceptable?
There was an independent review carried out about 2 years ago. It's currently being refreshed of our capacity to meet demand. That showed that the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service had 330 staff less than required to provide the level of service we should be. On the back of that analysis, we undertook that consultation on a new clinical response model that received broad support from the public, from elected representatives and others. I'm currently liaising with the department in relation to that to seek a decision on whether we move ahead with that.
Move ahead with what, sorry, Michael?
With introducing the new clinical response model and associated investment. There will be a significant investment required for us to be able to fully implement that. We currently have less than 1,000 frontline staff across Northern Ireland, and that's emergency and non-emergency. So an increase of 330, an uplift of one-third, is a significant increase.
So this is about money as well?
Everything is about money, but it's not only about money. What we would not do is simply put in hundreds of additional staff into the model that we currently have. So we are seeking to change our model and increase our staffing to provide that model more effectively. In the meantime, so that's a lot of work that's happening, strategic work that is seen as very important and recognised as being important. In the meantime, the Department of Health and our commissioners have shown their commitment to address our shortfall in staffing by allocating almost £5 million out of the supply and confidence money for us to train more paramedics. So as well as training the 48 paramedics, we are training and recruiting 96 emergency medical technicians and 96 ambulance care assistants. So almost 250 more staff being recruited and trained over the starting 4 to 6 months ago, and will continue for the next year.
And just one final question from me, Michael, as an aside. Did the strike on Friday affect the ambulance service and crews?
No, that was not a strike affecting health service employees.
Okay. Listen, thanks very much indeed for coming on and being so open about the situation. I appreciate it, Michael. Morning to you. That's Michael Bloomfield, the Chief Exec of the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. Some of you were complaining at the top of the show today that, look, maybe we need the Nolan Show on more during the day in terms of more hours. I can tell you now that's not going to happen. But my point is you can continue to talk to us and we can talk to you through all the different social media sites.